This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and however you are listening, thank you. This is a trial of the week where I review a landmark article in critical care and emergency medicine published this month in medical history. And today's article is a landmark one that may be a little less well-known than some of our other favorites, Sepsis PAM, the 2014 New England Journal of Medicine study featuring the amazing Kat Spisano. So we set the scene describing the concept of autoregulation and how that plays a key part in the hypothesis of this study before reviewing if there are any research or guideline recommendations supporting this theory. Then we dive into the trial of the week. Would we see the same results with other vasopressors? How many patients were in their target blood pressure ranges, how to balance longer ICU stays with the possibility of improved outcomes, and is there a better trial acronym? And then where are we now? Highlighting the best studies since Sepsis PAM, discussion on integrating personal medicine into septic shock, and much, much more. Our April trial of the week is a great one, so let's get going.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
And today's very special guest for our trial of the week is Catherine Spisano. Now, Kat is a MICU pharmacist and assistant RPD for the Critical Care PGY2 program at the University of Kentucky Healthcare in Lexington, Kentucky, aka Lex Vegas. Kat, welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on. This is awesome.
The pleasure is all mine. And I got to say, Assistant RPD, congrats on making it through recruitment season here on the Pharmacy Dose Pod. We understand everything that residents, students, learners, everyone goes through. Also understand the other side of things. So glad you made it out of the other side. How doing? Great.
Yeah, it was fun. It's my first year as assistant RPD. So first time through recruitment on the other side. Learned a lot, and very happy to have matched our three great residents, but very happy that it's over and we can have some downtime as we prep for starting next year. So good on both sides. It was an awesome first year.
Oh, that's awesome. First year, very, very lucky for everyone to get to work with you. Now let's get into our trial of the week, the Sepsis PAM study. And as we set the scene and talk about background, I think the first thing we have to do is describe what is autoregulation, because I think this term is critical to understanding the hypothesis behind the Sepsis PAM study and the benefit of having different blood pressure goals.
I totally agree. The rationale of this study was definitely built on the concept that our body is designed to have basically a near constant blood flow to our brain and other vascular beds, despite any changes we might have to any perfusion pressure going on. Autoregulation has been designed to maintain over wide varieties of perfusion pressures, ranging anywhere from like 60 to 160 millimeters of mercury. And below or above this pressure, autoregulation is completely lost. So when we lose autoregulation, perfusion becomes very linear with pressure, or as mainly we refer to it, mean arterial pressure, or MAP. Two main components go into determining autoregulation in the cerebral perfusion pressure. systemic pressure or MAP and intracranial pressure or ICP. And there's actually a really nice equation, very simple equation that goes into that, where it's CPP or cerebral perfusion pressure equals MAP minus ICP. And I know this is a podcast, so there's no visuals allowed, but I would encourage everyone to look up the really nice picture about the autoregulation curve. It's really good, it's really great, and it very clearly explains this concept and the drop off at either extreme. So I love that visual, love that graphic. Always use that when teaching this concept as well. In most patients, cerebral perfusion pressure is dictated by MAP, as we talked about. Says ICP is usually relatively constant. So in shock, when our MAP drops below that threshold, which is likely very patient specific, but generally thought to be around 60 millimeters of mercury, autoregulation fails and our brain can experience ischemia due to lack of that blood flow that it's getting. This ties into sepsis PAM because that autoregulation curve is actually shifted to the right in patients with chronic hypertension, meaning that the MAP threshold for cerebral ischemia is actually higher, meaning maybe it's not 60 millimeters of mercury, maybe it's 70. So targeting the generally accepted MAP goal of 65 for patients in septic shock might not actually be appropriate. And so we kind of set out to check that out. In a broad range of patients, but then again in that subgroup as well.
At the time of this publication, right, this is April of 2014, we're following the 2012 version of the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines. So, did they address the idea of using different MAP goals than our kind of gold standard of greater than or equal to 65?
Yeah, so they're recommending that we target the MAP of 65 initially while on vasopressors, with the caveat that if a patient has atherosclerosis and/or hypertension, we might require a higher target. So they make that caveat in the 2012 guidelines.
Essentially implying what you were saying in that autoregulation, that those patients would be shifted to the right because of those kind of pre-existing disease states. So talked about the guidelines, and there were some smaller single center studies, retrospective observational, but any research that we would rate as high quality, or was this more of like a theory based on a very, very real and logical understanding of our body's pathophysiology?
It's mainly was pretty much backed by just knowing the pathophysiology of that autoregulation curve. The recommendation in the sepsis guidelines, surviving sepsis guidelines, was a grade 1C recommendation, meaning it's a strong recommendation, you should follow it, but very low quality of evidence to support that practice, meaning those single center retrospective studies you're talking about. So not much to support it.
Yeah, kind of one of those, you know, we do this a lot in medicine where we have a theory and then we're going to kind of study it. And this study kind of goes in line with a lot of what those others found. We won't get into any spoilers, but let's get into that trial of the week, the high versus low blood pressure target in patients with septic shock, aka the Sepsis PAM study. So published in April 2014 in the New England Journal of Medicine. So French multicenter open label randomized clinical trial. So adult patients in refractory septic shock were enrolled in 29 centers from March 2010 through December 2011. So refractory shock meant that they were fluid resuscitated. They were getting at least 30 mils per kilo. They required vasopressor therapy at a minimum of that norepinephrine equivalent of 0.1 mic per kilo per minute. And they needed that to be on that within 6 hours of starting vasopressors, that early acute phase. And just a reminder, in 2012, septic shock that was diagnosed, you're using the SIRS criteria 2+, and you had the presence of an organ dysfunction, and of course on vasopressors. So patients were randomized to a low target group, meaning probably more standard, right? But in this trial, more low, meaning a goal MAP range of 65 to 70, or the high target group targeting a MAP of 80 to 85. So if a patient in the high target group had a serious adverse event, their vasopressor rates were lower to target that 65 to 70 MAP goal as used in the low target group. And then they mention routine use of nephrotoxic agents were avoided except when clinically necessary. So they kind of give, you know, I'll refer to you all to the text, but they refer to things as like iodinated contrast dye, loop diuretics, those sort of things, and only using them when specifically indicated. Primary outcome, 28-day all-cause mortality with that pre-specified sample size calculation, 800 patients to reduce mortality 10% from 45% to 35%. So, Kat, hop in, say anything that I may have missed in the methods, and then get into what the sepsis PAM study results ultimately were.
Not much more to add, but just a few things to note. So this study done in 2014, conducted during a time where actually that activated protein C was on the market. So it was used in a very small subsection of these patients, less than 10% in each arm, equally distributed, so in either cohort. So probably doesn't affect our results too much, but maybe reduces some generalizability for today's practice. Also something to note, because we're going to allude and talk later about renal replacement therapy, kidney injury, those sorts of things. Their criteria for initiating renal replacement therapy was somewhat interesting and different from what I see in practice. So they initiated for like the typical things we see: metabolic acidosis, emergent hyperkalemia, uremia. So all a part of that AEIOU acronym that we have. However, they also included anuria and serum creatinine of greater than 5.65 milligrams per deciliter, which is not a criteria for renal replacement therapy. Typically in practice, we would just watch the patients for signs of volume overload. And certainly they may have progressed to this, and patients will progress to volume overload if they stay anuric for several days. However, maybe biases this trial somewhat. And when we look at our reported number of patients needed renal replacement therapy, seemed a little preemptive. So those are the big things that I want to highlight about the study. But overall, sepsis PAM found that there was no difference in 28-day mortality between their low target group and their high target MAP group. So essentially no difference between the two in picking targets. However, they did find an increased incidence of new onset atrial fibrillation in the high target MAP group. So potentially some harm associated with that. However, they also found in the subgroup of patients that had chronic hypertension, meaning just that they were on an antihypertensive at home, nothing really about what their chronic blood pressure was at home or anything like that, just the presence of that antihypertensive, they found in that subgroup of patients that they had a reduced need for renal replacement therapy and a reduced incidence of doubling of their serum creatinine in that high MAP target group. So maybe some benefit for those chronic hypertensive patients at home based off that subset of patients. So that's the high level overview of sepsis PAM. And I know we'll get more into the nitty gritty.
Got to point out too, so you highlighted the two significant findings. And let me just say, for that renal replacement therapy requirements, that confidence interval is 0.41 to 0.99. So we are just right at the limit. And it's very funny you mention creatinine. I guarantee that my residents are not listening to this, but I literally just talked to one of them about how creatinine does not matter with renal replacement therapy. And literally in one of our biggest studies, that was a possible indication. So there's probably people being like, Nick, what the heck? You just told me it doesn't matter. So I appreciate you highlighting that you also think that that is strange and not routinely done in practice. We did not plan this. There are multiple fun, my trial, interesting facts. Kat highlighted multiple of them. So that just shows same wavelength as we're going through the trial of the week here. Now, the text stated, right, there it was 29 centers, and the text stated that norepinephrine was a first-line vasopressor at 28 of them. So I think the first question that stands out to me is, if we're using an agent, a vasopressor that is not norepinephrine, do you think we would have seen these same results?
That's a really good question. I'll start by saying that off that norepinephrine is our first line vasopressor based off the surviving sepsis guidelines. So very appropriate that was the case. I don't think literature supports a different practice, but for the exercise of thought, the other center that utilized was included in the study was utilizing epinephrine as their first line vasopressor. Main difference between these two vasopressors is slightly greater affinity for the beta 2 receptor with epinephrine. I don't think that this slight difference really would change mortality, which was their primary outcome, or even potential benefit in reducing rate of renal replacement therapy. If anything, if we were using epinephrine as first line, we might have seen even higher rates of atrial fibrillation in the higher MAP goal cohort. But maybe not. Beta 1 activities affinity is relatively similar, but in practice, I feel like I might see more atrial fibrillation with epinephrine compared to norepinephrine. As for other vasopressors we might consider, I still don't think primary outcome of mortality would really change at all. Maybe if phenylephrine was utilized, rate of new diagnosis of atrial fibrillation would be decreased, but additional benefit from this might be lost due to the amount of fluid that's associated with phenylephrine and utilizing that as our first-line vasopressor. Additionally, vasopressin doesn't have really a large window for titration. Most institutions and guidelines now recommend a maximum dose of 0.04 units per hour due to increased rates of mesenteric ischemia going above those rates, and it's really not indicated as a monotherapy agent typically. And those are kind of our routine pressors. So I don't think really we're changing any outcomes if we're changing what presser we used first.
This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. I completely agree with you that not only do I think we wouldn't have seen it, I think this is the best case scenario. Like, I think if they're using, say, the two that popped in my mind were epinephrine and, I'm shuddering even saying this, dopamine, I think we would have seen way worse adverse effects. And who knows what you would have found. Maybe that would have led to worse outcomes other ways. So I agree, but I thought that's an important point because when we're thinking about using these, and we'll get into all the considerations with the higher MAP, what that leads to patient-wise, I think thinking about the vasopressor they're on is important because I think that also influences how much you'd want someone to be on a vasopressor longer or things like that.
Well, I agree.
So when we've, lots, one of the issues when we've talked about probably more in our neurocritical care populations and when they've looked at blood pressure goals, one of the biggest critiques when they look at studies or study findings is that patients randomized to specific goals aren't all, their blood pressures aren't always in the goals they're randomized or supposed to be targeted to. So this is kind of the same concept, right? Instead of trying to bring down or trying to bring up. So comparing those two, 65 to 70 in the low group, 80 to 85 in the high group, was there, what were the average kind of baseline MAPs in those two treatment arms?
Yeah, definitely important to note for this trial as well, because instead of comparing MAP of 70 or 65 to 70 to 80 to 85, like we were trying to do in this trial, we actually were more along the lines comparing 70, 75, 80 in the low target group to actually MAPs of 85 to 90. So pretty high MAPs for that high target range. So we didn't really answer the question of goal MAP 65. We were a lot higher than that in our low cohort even.
And that obviously is going to influence how we look at it, right? When somebody's supposed to be randomized to 65 to 70 and their baseline MAPs are above that, right? Essentially. So now one of the biggest things, right, when I'm thinking of a, if we were going to try to apply this, right, and let's say you're MICU, right, and you're targeting a higher MAP, that'll likely mean that these patients will have a longer or higher, meaning like a higher dose exposure to vasopressors. Now, I think anecdotally, all of us know being on vasopressors for a long time isn't great, right? Just in theory, we don't like that, but is there actually any like research to say like if this actually affects patient specific outcomes, or is this generally like a rule we're going to abide by?
Yeah. And to that point, in the sepsis PAM trial, we did see longer duration of vasopressors, higher doses of vasopressors in that high target arm. There actually was a meta-analysis done that included sepsis PAM, looking at the question of lower versus higher exposure to vasopressor therapy in vasodilatory hypotension. And what that trial found, they were actually looking for primary outcome being mortality at 90 days. And they found that you actually would have a lower mortality at 90 days with lower exposure to vasopressors. They do make the caveat that this is only moderate certainty of evidence, lowered for imprecision of results. So maybe not the best also results we can look at, but that's really what we've got going for us right now in terms of the literature. So maybe that potential signal that mortality will be increased if you're on pressors for longer at higher doses. But majority of outcomes we need to assess these types of things, you need a lot of patients to be included in these. So maybe that's why our meta-analysis showed this, whereas our randomized control trials don't. Even we probably need large numbers to assess adverse events like arrhythmias, mesenteric or digital ischemia, and things like that. All the things that we know are bad about being on high doses of pressors. But unfortunately, critical care trials don't get a lot of enrolled patients a lot of the time. We're often not meeting power. So that's kind of the struggle we have in assessing any of this with good quality literature.
That's a really good point on the adverse effects, because you think about sepsis PAM, we had about, what, 780, 790, and there was only 19 incidences of digital ischemia in that whole group. And we're talking about rates of norepinephrine, like 0.5 mics per kilo per minute. So it's a really good point on the power and just the sheer number of patients we would need to try to show that one led to a different adverse effect than the other. What a great hot off the press meta-analyses published in February 2023. I will highlight for any learners or anybody that pulls this article, it's interesting that in the abstract, in the data synthesis, it says lower exposure to vasopressors probably lowers 90-day mortality with a confidence interval of that crosses one. So that feels weird to say. I'm gonna step back. I'm just saying, learners, that's not, don't do that. That's not, you're gonna get a lot of red ink. Don't do that. The other thing, like with that, right, when we're talking about a longer or higher exposure, right, that increases the risk of arrhythmias. But in the era that we are in now, where beds are gold and getting people out of the ICU quicker is a very high target on everyone's list when you're thinking of priorities in the ICU. Can we justify improved AKI outcomes maybe versus a whole day longer in the ICU? Like, how I'm gonna, I have a hard, I've, I think researchers are gonna have a hard time showing that true benefit and the correlation, because I think people are gonna look at it and be like, well, people are staying in our ICUs longer. That's a problem.
Yeah, it's certainly a problem in this day and age where we can't get any bed movement, whether that's our ICUs are full of critically ill patients or we just simply cannot downgrade them to the floor because there are no floor beds. So it's really a problem. And I don't have a great answer to that. I think a lot of trials now are looking at surrogate outcomes such as AKI prevention or need for renal replacement therapy, because we've strayed away from mortality. It's just too hard for us to get the numbers to look at mortality in our critically ill patient population. So I think AKI prevention matters, but at the cost of a whole extra day in the ICU, that has a lot of probably cost analysis that would go into it. I think, and what was not reported in sepsis PAM, and probably is the greater question, especially with their kind of not pragmatic initiation of renal replacement therapy criteria, is was there a long-term benefit in terms of renal replacement therapy Were patients just put on renal replacement therapy for, a couple days, or did that lead to long-term need for hemodialysis? There is a lot of morbidity and mortality that comes with new initiation of renal replacement therapy. So for me, that's kind of more of the question is, was that a long-term effect that we noticed down the line that these patients then progressed to needing long-term dialysis? If we could prevent that, that's great. But if it's just a couple of days needing renal replacement therapy for anuria, I don't think an extra day in the ICU warrants that.
And it's funny you say we don't have, they haven't looked at that. And so I also agreed that was one of the things that stood out to me. That, and I also thought that we would see some sort of research into a neurologic outcomes in these patients when the whole concept of autoregulation is blood flow to the brain. So I thought it was strange we didn't get like an MRS or something like that, because that actually could be significant, but we have no clue, right? Because they didn't really look at it. And the sepsis PAM kind of data set, there's four post-hoc analyses from this study. Not one of them looked at long-term stuff. There's one thing I want to highlight. It's actually kind of interesting here. So published in 2019 in the Annals of Intensive Care, this is looking at the effect of MAP on arousal in sedated ventilated patients. Now, arousal means an increase in RASS score. I don't know where everyone else's head was at, but it is an improvement. So it would be like instead of -3 or -4, it would be -2 or -3, right? An improvement in that. And what their thought was, hey, if we have a higher blood pressure, I bet you might be more awake. And ironically, I'm going to ignore the fact that the average RASS score was like -4 in this study, -3 and -4, but it actually showed an improvement by at least one percentage point when you targeted a higher MAP goal. So kind of interesting. I would say exclusively interesting, maybe hypothesis generating at the most. That leads into some trial interesting facts. So I always like to pull the supplementary appendix trial protocols to get the whole feel. So if you did that for sepsis PAM, you kind of got an interesting PDF pulled up because it's exclusively in French, like 210 pages of French. And they translate a couple English pages. So unless you are very well versed in the French language, the supplementary protocol and the trial details, given all that kind of background stuff, that will not be helpful for you. You mentioned the Zegras piece. That was a very, I also found that very interesting, a throwback, the activated protein C. The other thing that really stood out was in a past medical history, this is something that I don't think we see a lot in our patients. 35% of them had cancer or an autoimmune disease. In a trial like this, I don't know why that feels high to me. Maybe it's how they looked at it. I'm not sure. So less interesting and fun than some, but come on, trial of the week. I still bring the fun facts here. So I think that's anything else we need to highlight from the trial itself. I think we did a pretty good deep dive into that, Kat.
Yeah, I think so. There's not more much more to highlight, to pull out. It was a good study. They did what they were supposed to do. But it's gonna be hard pulling out what we can take away.
My only, not a criticism, I will critique acronyms. And the fact, what a miss that this wasn't sepsis MAP. Like, what a miss. I'm telling you, if there's anybody listening and you have a trial and you're like, I'm trying to find the perfect acronym, I'm available for hire, because what a miss. And what we've learned, especially with the March Madness bracket, the better your acronym or name is, the more chances that people will look at or know your study. So let's move from sepsis. I literally almost called it sepsis MAP, sepsis PAM, to where are we now? And the best study, you would say, or most high quality study since sepsis PAM is the OVATION pilot trial. That's comparing our MAP goals. So what did the Canadian researchers find in this 2016 study? Is it more the same or a little bit different?
Same, but different. It is randomizing patients suffering from vasodilatory shock to into two MAP goal targets, just like sepsis PAM did. Their goals were a little different, so 60 to 65 compared to 75 to 80. And it was a pilot trial, so that kind of affects what primary outcomes they were looking at and how many patients were enrolled in all of that. So primary outcome was not clinical, but rather just can we achieve a separation in MAP between the groups and reporting protocol deviations. They did find a MAP difference of 9 millimeters of mercury between groups, but no other outcome that they looked at, including mortality, incidence of arrhythmia, nothing was different between each of these cohorts. So similar to sepsis PAM in that regard. However, what is interesting about this, they actually did a subgroup looking at older patients, so patients 75 or older. And they actually saw that the lower MAP target in those patients was actually showed to have a reduced hospital mortality, 13% versus 60%. So an extremely large difference in percentage there, p-value of 0.03. So whereas maybe those patients we typically would think are more chronic hypertensives, more atherosclerosis, this trial actually kind of found that the older you are, the lower MAP goal maybe is beneficial for you.
You know, we introduced at the very beginning of the episode this concept of autoregulation, and that's at the center of this study. And, you know, we've highlighted on other sepsis episodes, as well as just other episodes in general, this idea and concept of personalized medicine. And the bundles and protocols for all are kind of going by the wayside. So I think one of the challenges is how do we know who should have a higher target, who would potentially benefit? Because there still are signals that there are people that could benefit from these. But is there any way for us to just know, like when they come in, like, hey, we should probably do this? Or is it more complex than that?
I think it's really tricky in clinical practice to figure this out. Based on the literature have, and we reviewed a lot of it here, it's reasonable, I think, to start empirically targeting a MAP of 65. If you have adequately fluid resuscitated the patient, you're achieving your MAP targets, but the patient is still showing signs of hypoperfusion, then maybe we can start considering adjusting their MAP goal. So some things that you can look at to kind of indicate hyperperfusion is happening despite meeting your MAP goal is like looking at persistently elevated lactate and you don't have any other reason that that might be high. You know, if they come in for septic shock, you're treating their infection. You think the antibiotics are appropriate for the organism. Maybe you've identified all of that. You've got source control. Maybe if you have a persistently elevated lactate, that MAP goal is not appropriate. Patients having adequate urine output. So, are they still peeing despite being at a MAP of 65? Other things that I looked into when like looking at should we be more personalizing this MAP goal? Some literature suggests looking at mixed venous oxygen saturation. So, are we adequately extracting oxygen? And carbon dioxide veno-arterial gradient. I'm not going to say I've ever used that in practice, but it is out there. So maybe start looking at all of these things and we can start putting the picture together for patients. If the MAP of 65 goal doesn't seem to be working for them, we do have the ability to change it. Also, maybe not accessible information, especially when they roll into the door. But if we could ever figure out what their baseline blood pressure or MAP is prior to them being in septic shock, that's probably going to be the most helpful in guiding our target. Again, really hard information to find, especially if they're presenting to your hospital system for the first time. And you don't have really good family involvement that really knows about their medical care, and assuming they're intubated, sedated at this point, very difficult information to have, but that's probably the best determinant of whether they could benefit from a higher goal.
Yeah, it really is absolutely challenging. The only tip that I have is you can go, and this is only if you get lucky, and this person, you either have shared record systems or they get their primary or consistent care in your system where you can see these. But the only trick we can sometimes see is we'll pull office visits. Like, what was their ambulatory blood pressure when they're going for their checkups and stuff like that? And again, sometimes that's not even super helpful. So either way, I like that you not only, because you're 100% right, it is complicated, but I like that you provided a pretty pragmatic approach of what to do. And if you're not getting your target at 65, okay, here's where we kind of delineate and think about things from there. So that's, I think, really great advice for everyone listening. So we talked about the 2012 guidelines, and the sepsis guidelines were kind of open to this MAP goal change, right? They were dancing around. They didn't use that specific language. But has the stance changed in those updated 2021 guidelines based on some of this evidence you've talked about?
Yeah, so the guidelines and the recommendation is basically the same, not changed at all. They're still recommending that target MAP of 65. And actually, we're now citing it as not low quality of evidence. We have moderate quality evidence now. So we've actually upgraded our level of evidence from the couple of trials we've talked about today. So we're still hanging our hat on 65 being the best. But if you really dive into the literature as we did today, I think there are certain opportunities to individualize that MAP goal, but 65 is probably where we can start for our patients.
Kat, this was amazing. Not only talking about the landmark sepsis PAM study, but have you coming on, share all of your knowledge and advice, tips and tricks for the listeners. Everyone reach out to Kat. It's at Kat Spaz Farm D. That's actually great. SPAZ. Reach out to her. Let her know what an awesome job this is. Kat, appreciate you for coming on. The thanks is all on this side.
Yeah, thanks so much for the invite. This was really fun. I'm happy to do it. I love, you know, tearing down the articles and talking the nitty gritty about it. So this is what I love.
Yeah, this was a blast. Thank you. That was great. Thanks again, Kat. And reach out to me. Let me know what your thoughts, ideas, suggestions are at Pharmacy to Dose. A reference list with links to these articles will be in the episode description, as well as the website, of course, pharmacytodose.com. And until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only and does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials on the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. The user or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN. ACP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.